In 2014, Oduoluwa Lange left her job in private equity to start TLP Advisory, the first legal firm dedicated to Nigeria's growing startup scene. In the 8 years since that decision, the firm has worked with some of Africa's biggest startups, including Piggyvest and Flutterwave. Recently, the firm was involved in crafting the Nigeria Startup Bill, and in this episode of Equity Merchants, I speak with Odun to learn what life as a startup lawyer feels like. Before we get in, let's take a message from the TechPoint Africa business team.
Hi, I'm Abisola Adenoga, the head of business at TechPoint Africa. Are you an early-stage startup looking for brand awareness for your organization or in search of potential investors and product engagement? Leverage TechPoint Africa's extensive network of startups, tech enthusiasts, investors, and executives on the African continent and beyond to elevate your brand and business. For inquiries, please send us an email to business@techpoint.africa or click on the link in the description. Together, let's take your business to the next level.
All right, so we are going to start with the first question, to just be kind of a personal question. So just tell us about yourself.
Okay, I'm Oduoluwa Lange. I am a venture lawyer. Everybody calls me Odu. So I've been a lawyer.
What do you prefer?
Odun's fine. As long as it's not Odu Ayo and it's not Oduola, my name is Odu or Oduoluwa.
Okay.
I've been a lawyer for about 15 years, started out in a law firm, and then I worked in investment banking before deciding I wanted to work with entrepreneurs. So I've been a venture lawyer for about 8 years now. I'm also co-founder of a legal tech startup called DIY Law, and basically just enjoy working with founders and those who fund them and those who invest in them.
Okay, so you were in investment banking for a while, and you also worked as a lawyer before you decided to just focus on startups and their investors. What made you decide to do that?
So when I was in investment banking, I worked on the private equity desk.
Okay.
But, you know, private equity is working with bigger businesses, and I was on the investor side a lot. However, I had a few friends who had gotten into tech then and would always reach out to me for advice, informal advice, and I found I enjoyed that a lot. I felt I was making more of a difference working with people who were building, you know, people who were just starting in tech. So that I gravitated towards that, and well, the rest is history. We started the practice, and now that's all I do.
So you're the co-founder at DIY Law and also the co-founder at TLP Advisory.
Yes.
So how? What do those two organizations do?
TLP Advisory is a venture law firm. We are a niche law firm that focuses on working within the startup or entrepreneurial ecosystem. So we like to say we work with founders and funders. We have offices in Lagos, London, and New York. For DIY Law, it's a legal technology company. It is not a law firm. It doesn't provide advisory. It just provides a platform where entrepreneurs, small business owners can get some legal processes done by themselves. So you want to register a business, you need some simple legal documents. So if you even want to access a lawyer for advice, we have a legal listing. We have DIY processes for you to create some simple legal documents. If you want to do some registration processes like registering your company, applying for a trademark or copyright, you can do that on DIY Law as well. And we have a lot of content on simple answers on legal issues on DIY Law as well.
So is it like a non-profit or is it a paid for service?
It's a paid for service. Parts of it are paid for service. Accessing the lawyers is free, you know, obviously the content is free as well, but it is much more affordable than you would if you went to a law firm. Even if you came to TLP Advisory, you'll be paying more. So there's some services that you may find on DIY Law that we also offer at TLP Advisory, but because, you know, you're putting in time, lawyers put in time, so you pay for that resources. But with DIY Law, you're doing some of the work yourself, right? So it's at a much more affordable cost than you would if you went to a law firm.
All right. You've been running TLP Advisory for 8 years. That's a really long time. You're probably one of the first lawyers who decided to focus on tech.
We were the first.
Interesting.
As a Nigeria, we were the first. Focused. Yeah.
Interesting. So, as the first law firm to be startup focused in Nigeria, how has that been? First of all, let's start with what have been some of your milestones since then.
It's a lot of milestones, and I would say most of our milestones are the milestones that our clients achieve. For quite a number of our clients, we started with them when they were just starting, some of them even before they incorporated. So seeing their growth, seeing some of them going to raise Series B, Series C, Series D, it's very exciting that we are some part of that story. Like we said, we started 2014. We started as a small law firm in a very small table in a general workspace. We've grown to a team of almost 20 now, both legal and non-law partners that support us. We merged with a law firm last year in New York, which is why we now have presence in New York. We got qualified to be able to practice from the UK, which is why we now have presence in London. So I'll say every year is a milestone for every progress on our clients' parts is a milestone. And on our own part, when they grow, we grow. We started at a time where founders got very, very, very horrible terms, investment terms, to get just maybe $20,000 or $30,000. And now we're hearing people raise. In fact, if you raised $200,000, $200,000, $400,000, it was such a big deal right then. But now $400,000 is pre-seed. In fact, a small pre-seed. So seeing the ecosystem grow, seeing the ecosystem, being part of that journey is a milestone. Being part of even framing the policies, we were one of the two law firms that worked on the Nigerian Startup Bill. So being part of all that journey and being able to influence both on a micro and macro level is very exciting for us.
Okay. So who was your first client?
Our first client, so we had two, three clients at the same time, but our first client was Big Cabal Media, Tech Cabal. Chidi Tilo was a friend, and he was one of those friends that would reach out to me. But soon after that, we had Ella. That's now defunct, but we then had Printivo, we had S&T. So those were our first set of clients. I'm still seeing that some of them, the majority of them are still doing their businesses for us. That's a milestone as well.
Okay. So can you share some of your other notable clients?
Okay, there are some those that are already in the public, I am happy to mention. But those that are, there's a lawyer client's confidentiality. So if a client has not mentioned that we're their client, we don't do that until they do or they've acknowledged that. I'll start with the more recent one that we actually posted about on our social media. Of the 60 the black founders that were funded by Google, we've worked with over 10% of those clients. So for us, it's a thing of, and this is an African-wide thing, not just Nigeria. So we've worked with about maybe 14 to 15 pictures. We have quite a number of clients on that list. Health Tracker, Steers, I'm trying to remember that list. quite a number of them, we did a post on that. We also work with clients like Piggyvest, clients like Flutterwave, Bankly. Let me see, the non-fintechs. We work with investors like Venture Platform. We provide, we're lawyers to ARM for their venture ARM. They have a venture arm where they invest in startups. So we work with ARM as well. We work with, who are the non-fintechs? I've mentioned some health techs. I've mentioned Steers as well. And so quite a number of the names you probably know, we work with them behind the scenes. As lawyers, we keep more of we let the clients talk about us more than we talk about them. And only when they do so are we also allowed to do so.
Talk about
quite a number on both on the investor and investment side. Lagos Angel Network, African Business Angel Network, quite a number. Yeah.
Okay, that's quite an impressive list of the who is who in Nigerian tech, so, and African tech as well. So that's impressive. So you've worked with startups, but you've also worked with like more established, larger companies. Is there anything different about working with these two types of businesses, and what would you say are the differences?
There is a difference. When we work with the larger type of businesses, the work we do with them is based on maybe their startup, you know, what they're doing in the startup sector, in the venture sector. While generally part of our work as lawyers is also a bit of educating and teaching, there's more of educating and teaching on the bigger kind, the bigger type of investors, because they're used to a certain type of way. Like when I started the journey, when we started the journey into venture capital, we also had to do a lot of unlearning. Most of, you know, coming from investment banking, what I knew was private equity. But private equity is very, even though they are both funding businesses, it's very different from venture capital. So there's a lot of unlearning and relearning. So that's one of the things that, you know, when you're working with bigger corporations that are used to that style of investment, that this is a bit different from what you know, and this is how you should go about it. But of course, timing is also different. The startups want things like yesterday, and they come and meet you like that yesterday. They come and meet you last minute and want it immediately. But with the larger type companies, they have processes in place already, and you know, things are done a bit more properly. But you know, it's both sides of the divide. As long as the way we view our client lenses, as long as you're contributing to the entrepreneurial ecosystem in one way or the other, then we're here to work with you. So we won't work with, for instance, even the same like an ARM or their other kind of initiatives, because that's not our strength. And that's not our focus. We won't work with someone who wants us to do like maybe, you know, call oil and gas corporate and not from an entrepreneurial perspective. Because again, that's not our strength. We know what we know and we don't know what we don't know.
That makes sense. So let's move on to something that you've probably faced. You mentioned just now that when you were moving from private equity to working with startups, there was a lot of unlearning that you had to do. And you now have a team of about 20, both legal and non-legal staff. And we know that the curriculum for the Nigerian Law School doesn't exactly teach students how to work in startup law. So how was that experience for you, and how did you go about ensuring that you have the right people for the job at every step?
Yeah, you're correct. You know, the curriculum doesn't really address that. So most of it is learning on the job. But what we look at fundamentally is, are you able to learn? Are you open to learning? And are you able to even self-learn? There's a lot of, we live in an era where information is abundant, right? So there's a lot of learning. There is a very strong, we have a very like strong onboarding for our lawyers. We prefer generally to hire young lawyers. It's easier to unlearn at that stage. So we prefer generally to work with young lawyers, and then they grow within our team. But it's a lot of reading. We are also, like when I started, there was very limited information on venture practice in Nigeria. In fact, there was no information. So part of what we try to do is contribute to this, you know, have a resource base, writes regularly on what people can learn, you know. We also run, one of the things we do, we run a periodic training for young lawyers that want to go into startup law. They don't work with us, but we just, you know, as a way of, this is a sector that is growing and it just needs more lawyers. So we do that. It's a physical one. We also have a graduate training program called TLP Kickstarters, where we bring some lawyers on board, young lawyers, work with them for a 3-month period. They get involved, how to work, not just learning venture law, but also how to work, support them in their career growth. And so that's our way of trying to create more lawyers that can, that understand how venture works and deepening the ecosystem.
Okay. So can you give me the numbers for how many people have gone through TLP Kickstarter since you started? Or when did you start it, by the way?
We just started, actually. We finished our pilot edition. We're running a second cycle. We're opening for a second cycle later this year. We just finished the first set. They had their dinner last week or 2 weeks ago. We're starting a second one. We're going to start a second one soon. Like an MVP, you learn. So that was our MVP. So a couple of tweaks there, and when that is done, we go out again. But we've had for the training for young lawyers, we've had I think we've had three, and then we have a network of three different trainings. We stopped during the COVID times because it used to be a physical thing. So, and since then, we didn't resume again, and it's one of the reasons why we thought, okay, let's have this graduate training program instead. So we've had like three bouts, and most classes will be like 10 people. So it's like,
So what are some of the topics that you cover?
Most of the topics, what most people want to learn is fundraising. There's that aspect of the different aspects of fundraising, but we also teach them the using technology to work. You can't say that you work with tech clients and you're not using tools that make you work better. So we teach them as well that about the tools that will make them work better. We talk about being agile, you know, just like you would if you're building a product. So some of those things that we apply from a services perspective. So we teach them about the law firm, and we teach them about the work, the kind of work that they will see, and basically client engagement. We've also had some of our clients talk to them. So we have we invite one of our clients to tell them what they like to see from lawyers.
Let's move on to to startups now. What are some of the legal issues that you feel startup founders should consider before launching their startup?
Before launching your startup, I think the first thing, one of the most important thing, is your co-founder relationship, especially when you're not a solo founder. It's I strongly advise that those details are ironed out and written out. You may or may not use a lawyer, but just make sure they're in writing. It's very important that everyone knows what their responsibilities are, and everyone knows, you know, manage expectations. What are you bringing to the table? And if there is ever a windfall, what are you taking away from the table? And what exactly are you expected to do? What role are you expected to function in, so that when you're not delivering on it, there's something we can refer to, and it's not, you know, we've seen enough founder disputes. I have seen enough founder disputes in my life to know how important that is. The second thing is realizing that there is no protection for ideas. It is only when you execute it. So that you discuss your idea with someone and the person does the same thing, there's really nothing you can do. It is when you have expressed that idea that you can, if it is protectable, that you can protect it. So it's being cautious and executing fast. That's what it is, you know, go to the market first. At the end of the day, whoever does better, who knows better, that has, you know, that wins the market. So executing fast. It's good to get some protection, some IP protection where it's applicable when you've done that, but there are no protection for ideas. I think the last one, it will be with the minute you want to start collecting other people's money, even if it is your father's money, as long as it is not capital and the plan is to either give him some profits or to return that money, please get it. Once you, every other thing, do it by yourself. You can find ways to maybe, you know, save money, but please get a lawyer. And there is a lawyer out there for every budget. You don't need to go get a big name lawyer if you're raising from family and friends, but just get someone who, and don't get your cousin lawyer that is an expert at litigation. Get someone who understands the sector. Any lawyer that tells you that they know everything is a bad lawyer. I don't know everything. So get someone who understands the sector.
Yeah.
And the minute you start collecting money, please have them involved. Don't go to the internet and just say, oh, I'm using a safe. YC has given us a safe, and I'm just going to adopt that. there's it could lead to bigger errors in the future. They're technical fundamentals, sometimes very little, but they matter in how you collect money and the kind of documentation you put in place.
All right. So now you mentioned that it's important to get a lawyer, but not just any lawyer, one who knows the space. And we already spoke about how the Nigerian law school doesn't teach for that. So how do founders balance that? Because now it means that there's only a very, very few number of law firms. So off the top of my head, I just know three law firms that are focused on startups. And you're one of them. There's Vazi Legal, and I think there's, I can't remember the name, but it's relatively new. And I'm just curious, how can founders get lawyers who are within their budget, especially at those very early stages? How can founders get lawyers within their budget?
There are quite a number of lawyers that are beginning to do this, but yes, the budget is what is important. I would say, ask around, talk to your friends, like you would, you know, if you need a referral. The same thing, if you want maybe you need someone to design your website, you're going to ask around and find that person within your budget that is going to do what you want. Ask around. We have, yes, most of our clients are gone, but we have staffer packages for people that are just starting. But still, not everyone may be able to afford, like, everyone's budget is different, but if you ask people, there is someone out there. I know that the DIY Law website has a few lawyers classified. You know, we have lawyers classified by practice areas and location. You can also check and see if there's a lawyer reach out to the lawyers listed there and see if anyone is within your budget. But look for referrals the same way you would find a referral to for a product designer, for an animator, for someone. Do the same.
All right. So there's a very important topic that I think we need to discuss, and that's the issue of compliance. So if you're, I think every Nigerian who pays some attention to the news is aware of what the regulator could do to you. Sometimes just out of the blues. And you see a lot of startup founders and then tell you, regulation always catches up with innovation. And it sounds very interesting, very, very adventurous to see. But then whenever regulation catches up with innovation, it's always innovation that has to pay the price for regulation catching up with it. What would you say are your tips for dealing with compliance from a founder's perspective, especially at the early stages when you're just trying to, you probably have this groundbreaking idea and you're just totally focused on getting your product out there and making sure that you have a market for it.
I'm also of the school of thought, you know, that innovation precedes regulation and regulation catches up. But it definitely will catch up. But first is, be sure when you're putting out a product as a founder, be sure that that regulation doesn't exist. Some people assume it doesn't exist. You might not know as a founder. Again, this is a time to speak with a lawyer. One of the things that lawyers do a lot is writing opinions. Let them write an opinion. Let them give you an opinion on the sector. Confirm that there's no regulation. If there's no regulation, what is the closest regulation, and are you able to get that regulation? I know that before you launch, you know, you don't know whether it's going to succeed or at that point, so you don't want to spend too much on regulation. But regulation is very important, especially for certain sectors. Fintech, most especially, you're dealing with people's lives, people's monies, people's savings, so it needs to be regulated. There needs to be that neutral person that's making sure that you're doing things correctly. But find out whether what you're doing is regulated or not. There was a time we didn't have crowdfunding regulation in Nigeria. Now we do. There was a time we didn't have regulation for online brokerage. Now we have the digital sub-broker license. So when some of these companies started, there was no regulation. But the sort of other ways, look for other ways to get regulatory cover. One of it is partnerships. A lot of the fintechs we have now, the Paystacks, the Flutterwaves, they started with a partnership with a bank. Because it wasn't clear what it is. That bank partnership gives you some regulatory cover. Before a bank is going to enter into a partnership with you, they do some level of their due diligence. What are you doing? Is this going to put us at risk as a bank? Is it going to put my license as a bank at risk? So partner with that bank, and let's be clear that, or you know, it could be a bank, it could be a broker. I know people that started with partnerships with broker, a securities company, you know. Let it be clear that it is both in terms of processes and in terms of what you have on your website, maybe your terms and conditions, that it is that party that at that time is providing that service, that you're just providing the tech platform to make it possible. Well, so that if your customer even has an issue, they know that it is not a the problem. They'll go and hold the bank, and it's not you that has that risk. So you need to mitigate your risk. But you know, one of the things we find is some clients are like, I don't want to put another person's name. You need to decide what you want. You want to mitigate your risk and your liability, or do you just want people to think that you're doing this? Most people know you're probably not doing it. It's most of your customers. The tech is as important as that core service. But while you're still where you don't have your license, focus on promoting your tech and giving the good experience. So do an opinion, get regulatory cover through partnerships pending when you can get your license. And where possible, apply for the sandbox. We have a CBN sandbox now. We have the SEC sandbox. So where you fit into that, apply for it. An aspect of compliance that people don't really look at is data protection. That is so important, and not just from a Nigerian or local perspective, even from a global perspective. Make sure you have your privacy policy, that it's in line with best practices. There is an NDPR regulation by NIDA in Nigeria, so make sure that you set up your privacy framework in line with that practice. If you're going to be serving non-Nigerian clients, especially if they fall within Europe, then make sure that you're GDPR compliant as well. And GDPR is a big deal, you know. So basically, just there's some little things you can do that won't cost you too much without you necessarily having to get a license. But both from a sector perspective and a data perspective, just make sure that you have things in place and you have the regulatory cover pending when you can afford, you know, your own license.
All right. So one of the, I think we had a space around compliance, I think this was last month, and one of the speakers mentioned engaging with regulators, like even before you actually need them, engaging with these regulators. I think one of the people listening asked about like relating with these people. So let's say you're just a regular Nigerian, you don't really have you don't have the network. You don't even have like the experience in that industry to say, oh, I've met these guys once or twice in the course of doing my work. How can these founders, especially now when we have, I mean, we are seeing 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds start businesses. So they don't have the experience. They probably don't have the network. So how can they go about relating with the regulator?
And then not everyone is even a network
networking
person, you know. But I would say where you can, if you go for events, some of these regulators come for events, right?
Okay.
Go and introduce yourself to them. Just say, hey, you know, try to make a connection, send them an email afterwards, say you met them at this. Even if you never say anything to them, who knows, when you're in trouble, you can leverage that relationship. Also, you know, I know there's that scarcity of lawyers, but work with lawyers that have these relationships as well. You know, you don't need to have the network. The way there was a time it was 6 degrees of separation. In these days of the internet, we're looking at 3 degrees of separation or 2 degrees of separation for most people. So, build your network around people that might have that network. It could be your lawyer, it could be your angel investors. The investors are very connected. Some of them angel, some of them institutional. So when you're raising money, don't think just about the money. Also think about, what did these people bring to this table? Then it could be a board of advisor. Do you want to have someone on your board of advisor that is well connected in your sector? Even if you don't want to have a board of directors, first, appoint the person as an advisor or consultancy. 0.2% equity, 0.3% equity that will vest. Leave it to them. Mm. You might, you know, get that network of someone who will introduce you. Belong to, you know, join groups. I know there is the FinTech Nigeria group as well. You might be able to leverage that. There's, I know that Lagos Chamber of Commerce has worked for some people in terms of regulatory network. Groups like Faith Foundation as well to also help their alumni to interface with regulators. So if you don't have that network, get someone that has that network, you know, make a network for someone that has that network to help you.
All right. So let's talk about investors. How founders can choose the right investors, because an investor can, a lot of the time, is like a long-term relationship, and choosing the wrong person could be the reason your business doesn't even get like follow-on funding and all. So what are some of your tips for choosing investors?
First tip, can I hire this person? If you can't hire them to work, don't take their money. It's not just about the money. If you feel that both of us cannot resume to work every day and have a good relationship, then why do you think that taking their money is going to work out? So first tip is, you know, do I really respect this person as a person? Do I respect what they bring to the table other than the cash? Then talk to other people they've invested in.
Okay.
What is the relationship like? What value have they brought other than money to the table? How have they helped? And now we're in an age where everybody wants to become an angel investor. Even people that know nothing about tech, everybody claims to be an angel investor or wants to be. So there's a lot of, you do have your experienced angel investors, but you also have people that don't understand the sector that are bringing in money. Educate them, or have your lawyer that's working with them educate them before you collect their money. Let them know that this money can disappear and not come back. It's high risk. But most people, most, especially angel investors, think it's automatic that they will get that money back or get the money and profit. So let them know that this money may never come back before you collect it. Let them know the risks that are involved. Preferably collect money from people that in the financial sector are called sophisticated investors, people who can educate themselves. So I might have a lot of money, but I don't even understand how the financial industry works. I don't understand how buying shares work. Not now talk of investing in
investing.
You know, so if you're taking from angel investors or friends and family, make sure they're sophisticated investors, or make sure that you educate them first on the implication of this money. It's a high risk asset base. Startup is a high risk asset base, high risk investment. But, you know, like they say, high risk, high reward if it works out. But if it doesn't work out, because how that becomes a problem is this person then starts disturbing you and wants my money back when you're supposed to be focusing on building your business or focusing on, you know, raising the next round. Let them also know that liquidity is a long-term thing. Take money from people who, it's not what they used to eat. It's not what they used to get by. Liquidity is most like, for frequent investors, it's, they know that liquidity is capital appreciation. I put in something at the seed level, and at Series A, it's appreciated to this amount, even though I don't have, it's not money in the bank, it's not money in the hand. But it's not worth this value until there's some form of liquidity. You won't be stressed by such investors. Be clear on the terms. Know whether it is safe, whether it is equity, whether it is convertible debt. Convertible debt means there's always, there might be that room to return the money, so be sure. Understand also that convertible debt means that at that early stage, you're already carrying debt on your books. So you are leveraged at your early stage. Most people don't realize that. They just feel since it's going to convert, a debt is a debt, whether there's convertible in front of it or not. So that means you're borrowing at that debt. Away from investors that have a high network, that have a good network, investors that have a support, you know, as you get to the higher stage, you're now in seed, your Series A, you're looking at institutional VCs. VCs that can introduce you to the investors you need in your next round. You, if you're being VC funded, it's most likely that until you're acquired or until you IPO, you are going to keep raising. That's something some startups don't realize. It's how that, if you're venture funded, that's how it works. So you don't say that, okay, I've raised up to Series B, I'm not doing it again, or yeah, let's start sharing profits. That's not why an institutional investor is putting money in your company. Mm. So raise from people that can introduce you to the next person you're going to raise from. Raise from people that can advise you, you know, if in your exit plan is an acquisition, raise from people that have that network, maybe that have invested in similar verticals, maybe in other countries, or similar verticals in other continents, so they're likely to be able to broker that acquisition for you if that's what you want. If you're looking at IPO, people who have experience in that, raise from fellow founders as well. Good fellow founders. I've seen some bad fellow founders. So good fellow founders that probably can give you strategic advice, even partnerships, collaborations, people that can give you introductions, strong networks, won't make your life hard. Know that it's a win-win. People that are not going to take too much equity from you. And just people that bring more to the table apart from cash. That's what you want to do most times.
Okay. So what do you think is like a good level of equity to give out at your pre-seed date?
There is really no rule of thumb in that sense. But what you find and what we usually, so how we look at this when someone will ask me this is, let's say you have YC ambitions. You know, one of the things YC looks at before they admit you is your cap table. How much equity have you given up? And they typically will say, YC will typically encourage maximum of 15% at the time you're applying to YC that you've given to other investors. Because the way investors look at it is, if you keep raising, do you still have enough with founders to motivate you? And you don't feel like an employee. So if you've given up too much at that early stage, they coming in will mean that you either can't raise more for their own capital to appreciate, or at some point you become disillusioned with what you're building and you walk away. So I'll say a maximum of 10 to 15 by seed. So pre-seed and seed, they're landing at that 15%.
Okay.
At the very worst, 20%, I would say,
Okay. So,
and of course, it also depends on how many founders there are, right? The more the more co-founders you have, you know, you want to be sure. But there are exceptions. There are exceptions. Like, you know, there's that common saying of, would you rather own 1% of a $1 billion company or 100% of a $1 million company? So, while it's a cliche, it's something to consider as well. So yes, there are exceptions.
So, okay. So my final question is around corporate governance. Recently, you were involved with the RiseVest issue. So you've had a lot of experience around corporate governance. And you've also worked in a very structured environment in private equity. So you have an idea of what corporate governance looks like in these large organizations. So what would you say corporate governance should look like at different stages of a startup's growth?
Definitely you can mirror what you have in large organizations, so that's going to like really hamper your growth. Okay. But corporate governance is first understanding that having a board, whether it's an advisory board at a very early stage or a board of directors, is not there to hamper you. Accountability is very important. We're all human beings, so it is what it is. If you're not accountable, things will go wrong. If you're pre-revenue or you're not that large, maybe just an advisory board, but you know, a proper advisory board that you probably have to send a report to maybe every quarter and have a meeting once a year. They will ask you questions. You know you have to report on certain things. But the minute you're a bit, you know, you get into that seed level, have a board. It could be a three-person board is fine. It doesn't have to be a large board. But there is that accountability measure. There's that thing of you have to get permission to do certain things. Have policies as you begin to grow. You begin to hit 7-10 employees. You don't need to have like a big employee handbook, but gradually begin to write things down so that people know that there are processes to follow. Not hard processes, things as simple as how do people requisition for money. Let there be a financial thread. Let there be, let people see how the money moves out, how the money moves in. How do people request for money? What is that? What do people approve? What are the reporting lines? A sexual harassment policy. As you begin to grow some more, how do people, you know, how do you share data internally? That's part of corporate governance as well. Approval frameworks. There are also things like the policies are very important, like I said, as you begin to grow and you would know what policy to put in place. Whistleblower policies, how can people report issues? When is the right time to have a people and culture? Maybe at some point it might just be a consultant, you outsource it. But later, when is the time to have someone in-house that actually oversees that function? And is that person empowered? It's important to empower someone over that and someone over how people relate. Corporate governance as well. Mostly it's putting accountability measures. You don't have to do the big company thing where you have a committee for everything, you know, a board committee for this, a board committee for that. That would delay you moving fast. But again, as you grow, you need to have a board committee. There comes a certain level where you even where you're big enough to have your C-suits, not necessarily reporting to you, but to the board. So that there's that separation as well. Separation. It's not only in governments that we talk about separation of powers, but if power is concentrated in a certain person or in a number of persons, then there's no accountability as well. So let them also report to the board on their function. Report to you. With recruitment, a transparent process as well. As you begin to grow, building appraisal systems, or do we just promote people the way we want? Those are part of corporate governance, just putting in different structures at different stages. But in that very early stage, at least start with an advisory board that you are actually accountable to, that you send reports to, and that you meet with periodically.
Okay. Something someone mentioned to me, I think in one of my interviews, was he advises that founders always have like an odd number. So the board, whether it's an advisory board or and not just an odd number that has more founders or like founders that can break the tie, but like an advisory board made up of outsiders, but an odd number. What do you think about that?
Odd number, yes, especially when it becomes a board of directors. So an advisory board does not necessarily have to vote, right? So it doesn't matter whether it's even numbered or odd. But if it's a board of directors, there's voting. You don't want to empower someone with a casting vote. So as long as the board is odd numbered, there would always be a majority. We don't have to, there's no risk of a tie. So that is important. It is also important to have independent board members. So usually this is how you see board grows. In the initial, let's say it's a two founder company. When they start, it's both co-founders that are on the board. When they raise proceed, they probably have an advisory board or, you know, advisors that advise them. By the time they're raising seed or their first institutional, that investor is probably asking for a board seat. So you have two founders on the board, and then you would have a third investor board representative. There will be some decisions that can only be taken when that investor is on board. But as you begin to grow, you know, and you have a wider board, you then need to have independent board members. Independent board members are people that don't have equity in that company at all. So let's say you've grown to having a 5-person board. Two may be representing the founders. Two may be representing investors. Then there's that fifth person that is in, that has no money in the company. You only pay the person maybe a salary, a sitting allowance for every time there's a meeting. But it's just look out there independently concerned about the company, and not because they have equity and have to look out for their own selfish interest when interests don't align. And you then keep growing that way, balancing it out with, or in that ratio 2-1.
There are
certain sectors that require that mandate that you have independent board members, and they'll tell you how many you must have, especially in the financial sector.
Of course. Okay. All right. Thank you so much for your time. This was really good. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode. As always, you can like, share, and subscribe to the podcast.